Before I forget, I want to quickly go through these basic pieces of equipment just so that you know what their proper names are and in some cases how they're used. What is this thing here? One piece of glassware. This is an Erlenmeyer flask, but it's fine to call it just a flask. This, on the other hand, is a beaker. And notice that they both are graduated. They both have tick marks on them indicating volume. But you would never make a careful measurement of volume using either one of those. They're more for storage or for doing things in them. Like today, we're using flasks. If you do want to make a more careful measurement of liquid, though, you would use this thing, which also has graduations. It's why it's called a graduated cylinder. And specifically, if you want to make careful measurements of other than microscopic amounts of liquid, then you use whichever size graduated cylinder is the smallest one that is big enough to do the job. You don't want to necessarily use the smallest one you have, because if, for instance, you use this graduated cylinder to measure a liter, you're going to have to do it in many batches, right? Each of which has a little error associated with it, so those errors can add up. You'd want to use the biggest one available for the job, the smallest one that's big enough for the job. The measurement of even smaller amounts of liquid, because there are different sizes of graduated cylinders, is the job of these things, and they come in different sizes as well. These are pipettes. And there are pipettes that, like this, that you just stick into some sort of suction device to draw the liquid up and read it on the graduations. But for even smaller liquids, you use what's called a micropipetter, which you never use unless you have a clean tip on it. This one doesn't have a tip at all. But this is for very tiny volumes of liquid. And I'll demonstrate how to use these when we actually use them later. But it's a micropipetter. This is a centrifuge tube, because it goes into a centrifuge. Centrifugation is a basic technique of separation. There are multiple different separation techniques, but centrifugation separates things in solution based on their relative masses. The heavy stuff falls to the bottom because it spins like hell, creating G-forces. The heavy stuff falls to the bottom, the lighter stuff is separated from it at the top. Just the opposite, doing the opposite job, I should say, is this, which is a vortexer. That will mix things together in a test tube. If you add ingredients to a test tube, and then if this is turned on and you press the test tube where my finger is, it will spin and create a little vortex to mix the thing well. This is a striker, which just produces a spark to light a gas-driven Fischer burner. It's not a Bunsen burner, it's a Fischer burner, but it's a burner. We're heating things today, but we're using not open flame, which we will later. We're using just an electric heater, which you have a different version of here. This is a heater and a stirrer. It's a magnetic stirrer as well. You can put a beaker on here with liquid in it, and if you drop in a magnetic pellet and turn on the spinning magnet underneath, it will spin inside the beaker to mix the stuff up. And finally, this is a test tube holder. Pretty straightforward. Okay, so know the proper names of those. But more importantly, we can get to today's important concepts. Now, what is special about this week's lab? Any idea? Well, it's the first one that you're actually doing a procedure for, but even more special is it's the first procedure for which you have a corresponding lab report that will be due eventually. Remember, you only have three lab reports. You're not making a report each week, and in most weeks you're not, well, in no weeks are you handing anything in at the end of the day. The only thing that you get points for that day for in lab you've already done, that's the quiz. Well, and the pre-lab quiz on Canvas. Okay? Remember, though, it's important to do a good job while you're in here and take notes in your lab manual and keep that lab manual for your own study so you can do well in quizzes and eventually in the laboratory practicum. But you will have 3 weeks, including this week, in which you have a corresponding lab report to write. And those lab reports, as I said before, are not formalized lab reports with, like, introduction and materials and methods like you might have done in other courses. It's really just a matter of answering specifically the things that are asked for in that report's page in the manual. Each one is different, of course. So there's a page in the manual or in the PDF if you're using it telling you exactly what to include in your report. You don't have to rewrite the questions, just write the answers to them, however many there are. Those are never handed in hard copy. They need to be done in Word and submitted as a Word document through Canvas. And I don't have the due date memorized, but it's on Canvas, and remain aware of it. It's not tomorrow, it's not the next day. I give you some time to do it, but make sure you pay attention to when it's due. All right, any questions about that? Then let's talk about careful liquid measurement. Well, I actually already did that partially with saying that you use graduated cylinders to do careful liquid measurement. But the reason this makes sense, the reason why you would use a graduated cylinder versus a beaker, is that a graduated cylinder, they're both cylinders, but a graduated cylinder is much narrower than a wide beaker. And if you are adding liquid to a cylinder that is narrow, the addition of a specific volume is going to change the level of the liquid much more in a narrow tube than it is in a wide tube, right? Which is going to give you a lot more resolution in your measurement, in your reading about as far as matching up to tick marks. If you spread all your liquid out over a wide area, it's not going to change much vertically, and that's what you're actually using to measure it, is how much it changes vertically. So it gives you more resolution. But liquid in any narrow tube has what's called capillary attraction. A capillary is a narrow tube. For instance, a glass capillary tube in clinical settings you've probably used or have seen used. If you prick your finger and then just touch the capillary tube to that drop of blood, it will go against gravity right up the tube, right? Well, if you look at it close up, you'll see that it looks just like the liquid in a graduated cylinder, meaning that graduated cylinder has these tick marks that you want to match up to it. But the liquid level is not, unfortunately, a nice level surface, which would be nice for matching up to the tick marks. Instead, liquids form a meniscus, which is a curved surface rather than level. And there are two versions, either a negative meniscus, which has a downward curve, or a positive meniscus, an upward curve. It depends on the liquid. Water, which is what we're usually dealing with in biology, either water or an aqueous solution, water-based solution, water will form negative menisci. Mercury, on the other hand, if you look at an old mercury barometer, it will form a positive meniscus. Either one is a problem, though, right? Because you want to actually get a good measurement. And so the problem with a meniscus is where you measure it at. It has a range from here to here, right? That's the whole range of the thickness of the meniscus. Actually, if you think about it, the truth is somewhere in between those two extents. If you were to imagine flattening it out so it is level, it would be somewhere between the top and the bottom, right? That would be the truth. But we can't do that And so scientists have agreed, or they've come to a convention, that regardless of any meniscus, you always measure it at the extent of the curve, away from the sides of the glass. So for a negative meniscus, it's the bottom of it. And for a positive meniscus, it's the top of it. All right? Yes, that does have some error, but at least we're consistent if we always do it the same way. Okay, that's meniscus. Next, we have solvent, solution, solvent, solute, and molarity. Well, the first of these three, the S words here, are highly related and pertinent to today's activity. We deal with a lot of solutions in biology. In fact, metabolism, or life, the stuff that happens in cells, is really aqueous solution chemistry. It's chemistry that's happening in a solution that involves water. Not all solutions involve water, but biological solutions do. Anyway, any given solution is a type of mixture. There are different types of mixtures in chemistry, but a solution is a mixture in which one substance is dissolved in another substance. The thing that is doing the dissolving, in other words, the thing that dissolves the other thing, is the solvent. And it's usually in much greater abundance. The thing that is being dissolved by the solvent is the solute. The combination of the two, solvent and solute together, is the overall solution. And it can be as simple as having just one solvent and one solute, but there can be multiple solvents and multiple solutes. Also, solutions are typically liquid, but they don't have to be. There are gaseous solutions as well. We're going to be dealing today with liquid solutions, and more specifically, a solution in which the solvent is water, and therefore we can specifically say an aqueous solution, a solution in which the solvent is water, which is almost always the case for biology, but not necessarily for chemistry. All right, now those three things. Any question on those? Go ahead.
Could you repeat solvent one more time?
Solvent is the part of the solution, the member of the solution, that does the dissolving. It is dissolving the solutes. Right. And the solutes are the things that are being dissolved by the solvent.
Okay.
Yeah, usually there is, you know, if you have the overall mixture, that's the solution, and most of it is solvent. Now, molarity is a quantity. And specifically, it is a concentration. Now, concentration itself is a quantity. Concentration refers to the relative amount of solute in a solution. We often talk about the strength of a solution. So if it's saltwater solution, for instance, if you say that saltwater is strong, that means compared to another salt solution, there seems to be a lot of solute in it. Right? So concentration is some way of measuring how much solute there is in a solution compared to other species. But there's different ways of actually measuring that. So there are separate quantities that are all concentrations. Molarity is one way of measuring concentration. So it is a quantity, but it's more specific than concentration. Molality, for instance, is another way of measuring concentration. Totally different quantity, though, with different units. And we won't deal with molality in here. We'll deal with molarity. Molarity is the name, though, for the quantity. As you're already familiar with, quantities have corresponding units, right? The units of molarity are molar, and the symbol is capital M. Now, molar is a unit, and more specifically, it's a derived unit, so it's made up of other units. Really, molar is just shorthand for moles of solute per liter of solution. And this is not the way we do it, of course, but what that means, if you have a solution and you got in there and counted every single solute particle that's dissolved and then expressed that in number of moles, which is Avogadro's number, right? That huge number. Some number of Avogadro's number. And then divide that by the volume of the solution measured in liters, you would have molar. And that's why we describe solutions often as some number molar, like 3.2 molar. That's how you pronounce it, molar. All right, including today. Any questions on that? Good. Let's talk about physical and chemical changes. They're both changes, obviously. But a chemical change, as I was talking about in lecture, is one that changes the stuff you have. It involves a chemical reaction. So reactants get turned into products. A physical change, on the other hand, doesn't change the substance. For instance, today, for one of the treatments, you are boiling water. When you boil water, once it actually starts boiling, that is, it undergoes evaporation, which is a change in state from the liquid state to the gaseous state. Well, in both cases, liquid or water, it is still water. It's exactly the same molecules. There isn't a breaking of bonds and reformation of other bonds to change it into different stuff. It's still water molecules. Since it's water molecules in both cases, how can we tell whether it's liquid or gas? What's the difference between a liquid and a gas? What do you mean? Not absolutely. That's not true absolutely. It is true relatively. An isolated water molecule, a single water molecule, doesn't make sense to talk about it as a liquid, a solid, or a gas. So it's a population of molecules that we call either liquid, solid, or gas. And the big difference between a gas and a liquid is spacing. So a liquid has particles comparatively close together. In a gas, it's mostly space between the particles. And that's why what you were saying basically is that the liquid has a higher density than the gas because there are more particles packed into the same volume compared to a gas. It's still the same stuff, though. And similarly for a solid, you still have water molecules. You haven't changed it. So that's physical versus chemical. Now we want to talk about variables in scientific experiments. And there are three major categories of variables. Of course, any given variable is simply something whose value can change, right? It's a variable. But if you think about designing an experiment, you're trying to see whether a specific prediction will come true or not, right? That corresponds to a hypothesis. And so to test that properly, you want to see whether any changes that you notice are due to specific things that you're intentionally changing and not due to some random thing. Because there's all kinds of variables in the universe, and some of them might affect your results if you don't take precautions. In other words, there is a category of variables called controlled variables, which, of course, are variables. They can vary, but you as the scientist do your best to keep them from varying so that they will not affect the experiment because they really have nothing to do with the experiment. All right? The other two are independent and dependent variables. And I see students get these mixed up all the time, just like they mix up hypothesis and prediction. And they do make sense linguistically, but I think it's best to learn them just practically, based on what you do with them practically. The dependent variable in any given experiment is the thing that you as the experimenter measure. So in a sense, it's the output. Whereas the independent variable is the thing that you as the experimenter adjust. And then everything else, all the other variables, you want to keep those constant as much as possible. They're controlled variables. They have nothing to do with the experiment. So it's useful to think of a specific example. If I want to investigate how the concentration of a nutrient solution affects the growth rate of a plant, all I really want to know is what the effect of the nutrient solution, the concentration of the nutrient solution is, right? But that's not the only thing that necessarily affects the growth rate of plants. So there's all kinds of other variables that I want to eliminate or control, which is why I would use exactly the same type and size of pot for all the plants, same kind of soil, same amount of sunlight, same temperature, same species of plant. They all start out the same size. Those are controlled variables, right? The only thing that I would change from batch to batch is the thing that I am investigating, which is the concentration of the nutrient solution. I would give the same volume, because that would be another controlled variable, but its concentration would change. It would be stronger for some plants than others. Yeah, that's my independent variable, the thing that I adjust. And then the dependent variable would be the thing that I measure, which would be the actual growth rate, which there's many units you could use, for instance, but you could measure it, for instance, in centimeters per week of growth in height. Does that all make sense? So there's three categories of variables, but when it comes time to making a graph, which we usually do in science, because graphs are easy to look at and get the main gist of the outcome, we only graph two of those categories. We don't graph the controlled variables, those that we try to eliminate, right? So we graph dependent and independent. And in a typical two-dimensional graph, of course, there's a horizontal axis and a vertical axis. But if you're making this properly, the placement of the variables matters. Which axis should always feature the independent variable? Had a 50-50 shot. It's the horizontal axis should always be the independent variable. Okay, and I would never label it as independent variable. I'm doing this just to tell you where the variable goes. You would actually use the real name for the variable, right? The dependent variable always goes on the vertical axis. Now, it's called the dependent variable for linguistic reasons because really, by doing the experiment, you're trying to find out whether the dependent variable actually does depend on the value of the independent variable. If you think of this by analogy with a mathematical function, like f of x equals x squared, or y equals x squared, in other words, when you graph that for the positive numbers, it's going to give you half a parabola, right? And so the y value here, which is f of x, the y value on the vertical axis depends on what you put into it as the x value. So the independent variable is like the input. The dependent variable is like the output that you measure. Now, if you want to make a proper graph, not only would you not call these independent variable and dependent variable, you'd give them real names. Like in my example, the independent variable is what? My example experiment. Not nutrients. Concentration of nutrient solution. Nutrients just by itself would not be right. Because first of all, that implies I'm giving different nutrients to the different plants. I'm not. It's the same exact nutrient. It's a different concentration of it in solution that I'm giving to each of them. Okay, so I would spell that out, whatever it is. And for the vast majority of variables, they have units. So if there's units, then in parentheses after the descriptor, you would use the units that you would list the units that you use. For instance, molar. Okay, capital M. And then similarly, the dependent variable, which is growth rate of the plant, in parentheses, I would put, for instance, centimeters per week. That still wouldn't be a proper graph. The axes would be labeled properly, but it needs a title. And a title should actually describe the experiment that the graph is generated from. So a good title is not something like Bio 181 graph. Doesn't tell you anything at all about the experiment, right? It would be something like the effect of changing the nutrient concentration on the growth rate of plants, or something like that. Now, I should caution you about the optional use of the word versus. Sometimes we use versus when we describe a graph. Something versus something else. But it matters, and I think this laboratory manual gets this wrong. There's some errors in this manual, so be careful with this. You don't have to use the versus terminology, but if you do, it is always Y versus X, vertical versus horizontal, not the other way around. So it would be wrong in this graph to call this concentration of nutrient solution versus growth rate. It has to be growth rate versus concentration of nutrient solution. It's always dependent variable versus independent variable if you use the word versus, which you don't have to do. But when you see that, that's the way you should think of. And it still wouldn't be, even if I had a good title, I can't have a graph that is numeric unless I really have scales, right? So you have to have the proper scale. And it's not necessarily the case that you want to start at zero. If you measured concentrations between 4 and 6, and there were many of them in between, why would you start at 0 and then start 4 over here? You have a bunch of space here, right? So sometimes you use 0, sometimes you don't, for both axes. But you space the You space the axes appropriately so it's a little bit lower than your lowest value, up to a little bit higher than your highest value, spreading the data out in both directions. In other words, I don't want to see a graph that looks like this with the points all in one little corner of the graph. That means you didn't properly space your axes. And similarly, on an overall page, it would be bad to have a graph up here in the corner. You want to make your graph bigger so that you have more resolution in telling points apart. Okay, so there would be some numerical axis, for instance, if it's numbers we're working with, which it would be in this case. You have numbers to them, which you determine based on your actual data. Now, if you go through with the actual experiment that I'm using as an example, you would make measurements, right? You would get data, which is a plural word, by the way. Data is plural of datum, which is why you say data are or data will, not data is or data. Well, you would say will in either case. But anyway, each individual measurement on a graph will be a point, right? And so you'll have certain points. Those are real measurements, real data. These don't fall perfectly on a line or on a nice curve like a parabola, but it does look like they're not random, like there is a trend here, right? And it looks like it's linear more than anything else, even though they're not perfectly linear. So it would be reasonable in this case to draw a line of best fit, as it's called, which computers can do for you, but you can also do by hand. A line of best fit doesn't necessarily go through any individual datum point. It's the line of best fit if it gets as close as possible to as many as possible of the points. And so if you were using a transparent ruler so you don't cover up any points, you could come up with a line about like that. That's the line of best fit. And we do that not just to make it easier to look at for the graph, which is easier, but much more importantly, a line of best fit can then act as a measuring device for you, a predictive measuring device. What I mean here is that these real data, the points themselves, correspond only to values of the independent variable that you actually tested. In this case, concentrations that you actually made the solutions for, right? But once you're done with the experiment, it might be interesting to wonder what the growth rate would be for a concentration between ones that you actually measured. That's what the line of best fit can tell you a prediction for. Once you have the line of best fit, if you're interested in what the growth rate would be for this particular concentration, whatever it is, that you didn't actually use in your experiment, it's just a matter of going straight up to the line and then straight over to the Y value to read the particular growth rate that you would predict for that. This assumes that the line of best fit actually represents the trend. And that assumption gets more and more valid the more and more points you have, which is why, you know, if you have one point, you can't tell anything about a fit. If you have two, you can fit a perfect line, but maybe it's actually like this. So the more points you have, the more confident you are about the actual fit. Doing this bit, though, of going up to the line and then reading the corresponding Y value is what you do to use the line of best fit in any case. But there are two different categories of cases that have different words associated with them, which are interpolation and extrapolation. They use exactly the same technique of using the line, but there's a good reason for considering them differently. Inter means between, right? Interpolation is using this technique somewhere on the line of best fit between the lowest point you have and the highest point that you have. So anywhere in this range, using this technique, anywhere in that range would be interpolation. Using the same technique, though, outside of the range, either lower than the lowest, over here, because this is the lowest, or higher than the highest, is extrapolation. Extra means outside of. And that's a big deal, because they're both predictions. Interpolation and extrapolation are both predictions. But extrapolation is much riskier a prediction than interpolation. Interpolation is safer because you have used real values on both sides of it. For instance, if this were actually real data, it might be that this species of plant, whatever it is, does grow faster, the higher the concentration is, for a while. But maybe if you get it too strong, it's really unhealthy for the plant, and it might go down quickly and kill the plant. Well, if you just assume that beyond this highest one that you measure, it continues to be this linear trend, and you predict what it would be for out here, you would be way off. Right? So extrapolation is risky. You want to keep it to interpolation if you can. Does all of that make sense scientifically? Then let me talk just a little bit about how to do this procedure well. First of all, you can get through it a lot quicker if you work in groups, even though technically you could do this alone. But you can divide the labor and be doing two things at once if you work as a group. But any given week procedure you want to do well, just because that's the right thing to do. But on a week in which you have to write it up as a report, you really want to make sure you do a good job and get good quality data, because it's a hell of a lot easier to write about than to try to explain why your data are all over the place. Try to explain your mistakes, in other words. So I want to talk about some things that you should try to avoid in order to get good results. These bottles, and there's two sets of them that are the same. You can use either one. There's four different so-called solutions, even though only three of them technically are solutions. This is a zero molar sodium chloride solution, which means there's no sodium chloride in it. It's zero molar sodium chloride is just another word for pure water. Okay? But it's okay if we call it a solution. These other ones are proper solutions because they have water with sodium chloride in them. And by the way, the flask of dry salt is out here, not for you to use. It's just to show you how much salt is dissolved in that corresponding bottle, just to give you an idea of it. But you actually use the liquid from each bottle. And before you do deliver it into your flask to take back to your table, you should invert to make sure it's well mixed before you do that. Okay, and make careful volume measurements using the volume doesn't matter much, but do that anyway to get practice with graduated cylinders. Anyway, when it comes time to boiling it, you're doing that on your heaters. By the way, you should drag your heater up, make sure it's out from under the shelf, and crank it on high right now. Just remember that it's on and don't touch it. But if you get it preheated, things will speed up after I shut up. You can use multiple heaters since we're so sparse in here. And in fact, you can put diagonally two flasks on the same heater also to speed things up. But before you put your solution in your flask, put two or three of these glass beads in your flask as boiling chips. That'll just make it boil more controllably. It won't bubble out and be dangerous and harder to measure. All right, but obviously you don't want to spill those down the sink. So when you're done, and you make sure you get your data before you get rid of anything, but when you're done boiling, don't don't pour it down the sink. Pour it through this strainer so that we can collect the glass beads again. And if the bucket itself gets full, just lift this out and dump the bucket. Keep the glass beads separate. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. But you're using thermometers, these digital thermometers, to make measurements of temperature. That is your dependent variable, right? The boiling point is the thing you're measuring. That's the dependent variable. And it has nothing to do with the time. I always get people telling me in these reports that you measured the time it took to boil. You didn't do that. You're not going to do that. Doesn't matter how long it takes it to boil. It's what the temperature is when it starts to boil. Okay, the boiling point. But getting a good temperature means not sticking the temperature probe onto the bottom of the flask. You're going to get an inflated temperature because you're going to be measuring the temperature of the heater, not the liquid. So make sure it's just suspended in the liquid. Make sure it's also, I don't know whether these read out in Fahrenheit also, but make sure it's on centigrade mode. The biggest source of error, though, comes in for two reasons. One is that you want to get the temperature as it starts to boil. But what is boiling? That's something that you need to actually determine as a group beforehand. Does it mean the very first tiny bubble that shows up? Or does it mean a full raging boil? Or something in between? Something in between is probably the best. But the point is you want to come up with your idea of what boiling looks like before you start and use that same criterion to say, okay, now it's time for each of your different solutions. Okay? Making it consistent. But relatedly, and you might not realize this, but if you boil pure water, which is one of your so-called solutions, and by the way, this graph is not the graph you will give me. This one does involve time, but I'm doing this just to make this point. So if you graph temperature versus time as you heat water, the trace is going to go up because the water is getting hotter and hotter, right, as you add heat, until it reaches the boiling point, which is not necessarily exactly 100. It only is if it's exactly one atmosphere of pressure, which it's not here because we're elevated. So don't expect it to be exactly 100. But anyway, whatever the boiling point is, if it's pure water, when it reaches that boiling point, the water evaporates, changes state from liquid to gas, but the temperature is going to stay the same as long as it's boiling. You're adding more heat, but that additional heat is going into freeing more and more of the molecules from the liquid and putting them out into the gas state. The temperature stays the same. If you were to contain all of that gas, eventually there would be no more liquid left, and then once it's all gas, then it would start going up again if you continue to heat it. That's a nice safe situation because it doesn't really matter where in here, what you call boiling, it's going to be the same temperature because it's a plateau. And because the concentration doesn't change. As you boil water off of pure water, what's left behind is still pure water, right? The concentration doesn't change. But that's not true for the other solutions. For the salt solutions, you know, they'll increase as you heat them, but what happens when it starts to boil? Once again, there's evaporation, but it's not evaporation of everything that's in the solution. It's evaporation of the thing that's in the solution that has the lowest boiling point. Salt has a much higher boiling point than water does. So when the solution starts to boil, it's really just the water that's leaving. You have exactly the same amount of salt there still, but now you have less volume because you've lost some as gas, right? Which means the value of your concentration, which you want to keep constant, has changed. You have the same amount of solute, but less solution, less volume of solution, and therefore the more you boil it, the farther you get from what the concentration should have started at. Does that all make sense? That's why you need to get the temperature as soon as it meets your criterion for boiling. Don't keep it boiling. But come up with that criterion before you even start, and have the same person judge whether it's boiling for each of them. Other than that, it's pretty straightforward, so go ahead and get started.